This is Circulating Ideas, episode number 241. My name is Steve Thomas, and today we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of Library Reads with guests Rebecca Vanook, the Executive Director of Library Reads, and Stephanie Chase, Executive Director of the Libraries of Eastern Oregon and Founding Principal of the Constructive Disruption Consultancy, and a founding member and inaugural chair of the Library Reads Steering Committee. Circulating Ideas is brought to you with support from listeners just like you. Find out how you can help support the show by going to circulatingideas.com/support. And don't forget to sign up for the Circulating Ideas newsletter at circideas.substack.com. Rebecca and Stephanie, you've both been on the podcast before, so welcome back to Circulating Ideas.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
Library Reads is celebrating its 10th anniversary this month, and that is very exciting. For people who may not know, let's get back to the basics. What is Library Reads, and how did they get started in the first place?
I think back when we started Library Reads, so that was back starting in the late aughts, approaching the early 2010s, I think there was a lot of interest in more formalized support around Reader's Advisory. What we were seeing at Book Expo America started to welcome more librarians and library staff into that space. How could we really capitalize on the impact that libraries really do have in moving books forward, promoting authors, recognizing the role that libraries and library staff really play in discovery? If you cast your mind back, you can think back to how that was a really big discussion for a period of time. And so the story goes that at a Digipalooza, there was a conversation about how do we step into this space and why doesn't anything like the Indie Next list, which is put together by independent bookseller staff recommendations, why isn't there anything like Indie Next for libraries? That simple question just got the wheels turning among this group of people. Library staff were really involved in the Reader's Advisory space, involved in Book Expo America, had connections with what existed at the time with the Association of American Publishers, their trade libraries committee. There's just a lot of things swirling at the same time. So we decided to just try, see what would happen if we made it easy for library staff across the country to share what they were really excited about. What were they planning on promoting to their patrons? And recognizing that that is a very different thing than a best of list. It's really about what you're excited about, what you're excited to share, what you've loved reading and want to promote. And recognizing that for library staff in particular, a lot of those books are not the top bestsellers because they don't need our help. Our patrons are already coming in. We have long hold queues on those. It was really about bringing forward what are the things that we're recommending to patrons when they're waiting for the hold. So I think we just had this lovely kind of mix of all of those things coming together and really being able to start that and try. From the get-go, we really wanted to work with publishers to make that happen. Indie Next functions that way, that list. We were really lucky to have some key people at some of the big publishers at the time who were also really interested in this question about the role that libraries play in discovery, so that from the beginning, we could really count on support from the people who are putting out the books, the people who are promoting the books. And so that was a really important factor at that time, too.
When people ask me kind of like, how did this start and what do you compare yourselves to? Absolutely. I say we're based on the Indie Next list. And I also will tell people the same thing that you said. It's not a best of list. This is not an award committee. It's not a juried 10 people get to pick these books. No, it is the voice of library staff across the United States. The New York Times bestseller list. Everybody knows this book, and none of them are on the shelf right now. And so we are not trying to be that. We are trying to be a more personable companion to that list. That is one of the things that people like about our list that sets us apart are those annotations that come from library staffs. We could have easily just said, let's pull the top holds in America's library for this week. You know, Library Journal does that. We actually now work with them. I love it. Every Monday, they contact me with, here's the title that's got the most holds in America's library. Can you give us 3 Library Reads, past selections that would be good read-alikes? And to me, that's exactly the goal that we're trying to do is everybody knows those bestsellers. They know those top holds. we have this kind of extra kick to it with that personalized touch.
Rebecca, how did you end up getting involved with Library Reads?
At the time that Library Reads was formed, I was working at Booklist. So I, not being in the public library anymore, didn't want to kind of intrude on that space. We partnered up. I was asked a couple of times to MC different events because I had been working on behalf of Booklist with various publishers to do a lot of their author events and kind of became known for being able to do interviews and that sort of thing. And so right up until, I think it was right before you guys decided, Stephanie, to go bigger and incorporate and get an executive director, I had left Booklist and ran another magazine briefly and then was sort of out there available. The stars just kind of aligned perfectly that I was looking for my next thing to do. And Stephanie and the crew were looking for someone to run Library Reads. And it just kind of naturally fit together with both of our needs, which I'm forever grateful for.
We were volunteer led for, I think, the planning years. And then really, I think the first 4 years or so of our existence. So all volunteer time. We're able to hire a staff person as an administrative staff person, Allison, who's still with Library Reads, which is also awesome.
Over.
So when we were coming to that point, we knew we wanted to incorporate. We had done a lot of research about what type of organization we should be. That was my final job as the chair, was to finish the incorporation and hire the executive director. So it just felt we're at this great time where we had a lot under our belt. We knew what worked. We had strong relationships. And we also knew there was really no way that that original group, so the original group that really founded Library Reads, stayed engaged for a long time. We were talking about this as we were prepping. I think I was the chair of the steering committee, what the board was then called at the time, for 7 years. It was just such a good time to hand it over, really strong structure that had a brand that people knew about, to somebody who had the time. And then in our case, so lucky with Rebecca, like the connections, the expertise, the interest to just really keep moving the organization forward.
Could you talk a little bit about, you mentioned, Stephanie, especially when you're setting it up, of the working relationship with publishers. And I know a lot of the publishers have library marketing units. What's that relationship like with the publishers?
That could definitely start historic. And then Rebecca, I think you can bring us to where we are now. I think it's really important to remember that the list is 100% driven by library staff vote. So the publishers do not have any control whether something appears on the list or not, except for the push that they're going to put behind titles and materials. So when we started again, we were really looking at the way Indie Next worked as a model, and we approached the publishers to really help us get the organization off the ground. And I really want to do a shout out to Christopher Platt and Miriam Tuliao, who were on the original steering committee, who along with Nora Rawlinson really did such incredible work gaining support from publishers to essentially give us the seed money to get going. And you can see on the website, the founding partners, which included Hachette Book Group, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Other Press, the Penguin Group, Quirkus Publishing, Random House, they're together now, of course, Simon & Schuster, Workman, and W.W. Norton. So we were really lucky, again, to have publishers who recognized that this was a really effective way to focus their marketing and to also, again, get back some of what they were interested in looking for at the time, too, about how they can support and influence what's happening in the library market. From the beginning, there was that relationship and that understanding. At that time, too, Edelweiss and NetGalley were kind of in their infancy, I would say, in the library market. I know Library Reads continues to still do a lot of work about what does it mean to read pre-pub? What's an advanced reader's copy? We're in this place where we could really help publishers who were trying to make that transition. How do we start to have some of those same relationships with library staff, as often our reps really do with local bookstore staff?
Yes, I go all of that. And I think that what is really interesting is, as you mentioned, Steve, all of the top publishers and small ones as well have marketing teams that are specific to libraries. And I feel like Library Reads has given them a chance to focus on readers advisory folks in particular, I think anybody who has done reader's advisory in the last, you know, maybe 5 or so years, 10 years going back, we can identify the main players, right? We know the Katie Stovers of the world. We know Robin Bierbauer, and we know Robin Bradford, and we know these names that we see on reviews and that we see on websites and blurbs and that sort of thing. The publishers knew some of them, and Library Reads really helped them kind of realize there's more than just these top 40 people that keep voting. We have hundreds, and actually now we get thousands of votes every month. It became a really great way for them to focus their marketing efforts. To this day, when they're handing out their galleys at shows, or they're doing their mailings, or they're sending out their emails, they have our logo splashed all over it. They have our vote dates, the deadlines, splashed all over it. They make sure that they mention in their marketing emails, don't forget to vote for Library Read by June 1st. Like, they are really pushing it. And they will contact me to say, okay, what are the vote numbers looking like right now? What is the minimum number it takes to get on the list? Should we want to try and pick our 3 or 4 books this month that we really want to put a solid push behind? What do you think trend-wise? And that sort of thing. It just becomes this wonderful back and forth relationship that didn't really exist before. I think they all kind of had individual relationships with some of these bigger folks and with people at larger libraries, which great, but now their reach has gone even farther, and I'm really happy that we can facilitate that. We are seeing lately, especially last year was the first year we had exhibited at ARSL in person, and I can tell you with confidence the number of votes that we are seeing from people who had not voted previously, the number of people from smaller systems and smaller libraries has really shot up, which is very exciting. That's something I'm really pleased about. And I think the publishers are really pleased about that too, because the more reach, the better. One of the things that we did when the pandemic hit, and all of a sudden, hey, there's nowhere to go to, there are nowhere off panels, where do we get these galleys from? We really stepped up and said, what can we do virtually for you guys? How can we put together virtual author panels? Can we get folks to come and do your interviews for you or do your MCing? And how do we reach out to our user base to get them more invested in doing the downloads on Edelweiss and NetGalley? We really were shocked, I think, that during the pandemic, our numbers went up instead of down. I thought for sure, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to Ions? Are people, what are they going to do if they can't go to Book Expo and they can't go to ALA and come back with their 16 book bags full of galleys? And everyone really rose to the occasion and was like, that's cool. If I have to download it, I have to download it. We do have our users that love their downloads and love their Kindles, and that's all they want to do. But I was really surprised to see our numbers continue to go up every month. And they dipped slightly in March. And by May of 2020, they had gone right back to where they were and have grown ever since. I'm fascinated by that. And I think our publishing friends are really happy about that, because I'm sure that they were panicking. Like, what do we do if we don't have the in-person opportunities to give those galleys out anymore? So it's been interesting.
Well, I think as much as sometimes maybe some parts of a publishing unit don't appreciate libraries as much as we want, definitely there are parts of the publishing houses that see our value and work well with us and through organizations like Library Reads a lot of times to reach that market.
Yes. I don't have any concrete numbers, but I absolutely have anecdotal email evidence. When a book appears on the list, they see a spike in sales. Many reps tell me that, and they track all that very carefully, which is exciting to hear. So we definitely know we are making a difference in getting the word out about certain books.
Do they get the numbers from NetGalley and Edelweiss of how many are downloaded?
Here's the interesting thing. They get some numbers, but not a full picture. On the user side, when you're going to vote for a book on either platform, it asks if you want to share that information with the publisher. The user has to check the box in order for them to get those numbers, or at least to get those annotations. I'm not clear if they get actual numbers or not, but they will often email me and say, hey, we thought maybe this book was going to hit the list this month. And they can, of course, only see their own book. So it's kind of like the runners up in the Miss America pageant. Like, where do they all fall? So we know the point, so we will never tell. But they will often be like, we're expecting XYZ book to hit the list because we know it got 50 votes. Can you tell us what happened? And then I get to go look and say, well, you know, this month it took X number of votes to get on the list and just barely didn't make it. They watch that stuff very carefully. They're really invested in the demo that way.
How has Library Reads changed over the past decade? How is it different now than it was when it first got started as that volunteer loose organization?
I think when we started, we were really very focused on the list. We were really focused on having a product and doing what we could do, again, within our volunteer capacity to make that a strong, reliable, influential product. So to that extent, we spent a lot of time on those relationships with those partners. We spent time encouraging people to start reading Tree Pubs. Again, if you weren't in that small group, as Rebecca was talking about, it's a whole different practice to be reading 3 or 6 or 9 or 12 months in advance and to have access to the resources to do that. So we spent a lot of time on just encouraging people to think differently about their reading skills, why it's important to read pre-pub, the influence you can have on what's being published, what's being shared if you do that, to really make sure that we had a list that really highlighted, again, as Rebecca said, those voices that were not from the usual players. So how could we help the publishers really see the extent to which this is a space that library staff really do occupy and really can have a lot of power in? As the list started to really be strong and volunteers, we started adding some education component. We did an unconference a couple of years. Pretty early on, we did start working in some ways with novelists, sometimes supporting them in some of their webinars. But I think for me, the piece that has just really been so effective since Rebecca came on is really around the professional support and the training that Library Reads does.
So I'll jump in on that then. When I was interviewing for the job, the two things that I really tried to put out there to be a good candidate were, A, I had existing relationships with all of the publishers and with novelists and with ALA and Booklist and Library Journal. And B, I really saw the ability for our organization to start doing professional development for readers advisory. And again, my stars aligned and it all worked out that they were like, yes, that's what we want. And I'm feeling really happy that it's worked out that way, because what we've done in the last 5 years, we do a lot of workshops and webinars with Booklist. As I mentioned earlier, we do this weekly read-alikes thing with Library Journal, and a lot of our board members make themselves available to do different emceeing and hosting and interviewing. And we work now with our friends at Novelist on these crash course webinars and on other webinars and training things. And as Stephanie mentioned, so the volunteer group was doing the Unconference, which is a great way to just do one day all about readers advisory. Here we go. And that is really difficult to do with just volunteers. And it's difficult enough to do it when you actually have staff person too. But at least when I came on, then I kind of run the day and pull from our board to do the actual events. We had done two more since their original one, and then the pandemic hit. And that's when we shifted our focus to, what can we offer? Really, what should we be offering as opposed to how can we work with what is already in place? Like, let's not reinvent the wheel, right? So when we started talking to novelists, they were like, we want to do these genre webinars. How can we create these? They brought us in on the ground floor on that, which was excellent. And we're so pleased and proud to be part of that. It just sort of blossomed from there. We took the last unconference that we did, we took some pieces of that and have put it into a very flexible, very adaptable program that can be done as an online webinar or pre-recorded or taken out on the road, so to speak. We did several of those last year and are doing more for it this year. We are going out more and more now to various state and local conferences, knowing that that's how we reach some of these folks that don't get to go to ALA every year, or they don't get to go to PLA, but they can go to their state conference. So we're exhibiting at those conferences and we're offering up this program for free. I've done it on Zoom a few times already this year for various libraries. We are also fortunate to be in a place where we have funds to offer as well. So I'm going to do a little commercial plug here. Go to our website and under our participate tab, you'll see a little tab for continuing education and support. We have travel grants available to library folks who, as long as you are working in adult wage advisory services and you are heading to a conference that has content for adult readers advisors, we can help out with that. We also have funds available to give to institutions if they want to send folks to a webinar or they want to bring in a speaker or bring in an author. We've got that available. And I'm really, really pleased. That program is still kind of in its infancy, but we're excited to have that available. It was definitely one of my big goals. Because when you think about it, there aren't a lot of institutions or organizations that just focus on readers advisory. We wanted to be almost like a clearinghouse for that, right? We didn't want to take over what anybody else was already doing. And that is why I'm so grateful for the relationships that we have with Library Journal and Booklist and AMA and Novelist, that we're all working for the same goal. We want these books and authors to be promoted. We want readers' advisors to be learning constantly and to feel supported. And with the end goal of just having more books available for more readers. And the fact that we all kind of have that goal is this wonderful working relationship that we have. That so it's an exciting thing to be part of.
Yeah. Currently, where technology is ubiquitous and there's so many different competing forms of media out there, why do you think that libraries should continue to focus on books and reading?
Rebecca, I'm sure that you have some thoughts on this, but I think when you describe the reason why you think people wouldn't want it is precisely why people do. There is so much happening in the world. There's so much to choose from that when you can have someone you trust, and I think in this case, there's so much trust with library staff. When you're like, oh, library staff like this, I'll try it. It just is such an important part of that. People have long looked to library staff to help with guidance, and they love to see what we're reading. So it just really makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that for years, I've been, and you guys as well, I know, have been a librarian for 20-something years, and we've heard since we were in grad school, oh, who's going to need libraries anymore? You can Google anything you want, and blah, blah, blah. There's so many different forms of entertainment. Like, who's going to need this? And it's not going away anytime soon. Hasn't disappeared in those past 20 years, and I think it's not going to the next. And always laughing at the fact that we think that everyone is so consumed by social media, and don't get me wrong, they very much are. Look at book talk. Like, that is a thing. Who would have guessed it? Who would have thought that people would be talking about books on social media? And they do, and it's driving lots of sales. And I'm excited about that. So I feel like, to Stephanie's point, library folks, we're almost some of the original influencers, if I may say so boldly, right? Like, people know that we are the book people. We are the readers. We are the curators, if you will. Maybe the cultivators is a metaphor. We know books, and if we are enthusiastic about something, we mean it, because we don't have anything to sell, right? Everyone, even on social media, your favorite creators and your favorite influencers, at the bottom line, they're trying to sell you something, right? They're trying to make money. They're trying to push a product. And libraries have never been that way. We are excited about something because it's good. We are excited about something because we are enthusiastic and we want to share. And I think that is absolutely at the core of what we do, and it drives it, and it works. It works.
I think the market works in our favor too. I realized I should have looked this up, because certainly pre-pandemic, you had started to see this plateauing of adoption of digital reading. So you have the vast majority of the reading public still very much interested in reading in print. So I think that piece, as bookstores have disappeared, you can't go to Target and get someone to help you find something on the shelf. So again, libraries become this place where if you're really interested in that physical piece, then that's what you want. And I think when you look at some of the most successful services that public libraries in particular offered during the pandemic was curbside pickup. So the ability to still talk to someone about books, right? So out the window with your mask on to say what you were looking for and that you trusted library staff to bring you a bag of books. I think for me, every time you look at these studies, I know Pew has done a lot of research in this, younger people skew very heavily toward print. So you're describing a market that has not really changed its reading habits. It may have added, but it has not subtracted. So there's still such an interest, a desire to be reading in a physical print format. And the avenues to access that have continued to narrow.
For 20 years, we could say, hey, what's your most popular display in the library? It's actually the carton books that have just been returned by people.
Totally.
Like, everyone wants to know what their neighbors are reading. And everyone wants to know what's popular. And they want a personal suggestion. And that is kind of the enduring quality of library. There is a name attached to that vote. There is a person, it's the saying why you should read this, why they liked it. It really adds this very human and personal element to something that could be just a piece of paper with 10 books on it, or just a bestseller list. We're just going to base it off of what's popular. And the fact that it is a personal recommendation is always going to be our strongest suit. And I don't see that changing.
Yeah, you're kind of in the middle of bestseller list and best of list, because like best of list, you're getting one person's opinion about what the best books are. At bestseller list, you're getting just what's sold. But you guys are sort of, it's personal, but it's aggregated personal. So it's not just one person's opinion. A lot of people thought this was the best book this month. So you get that melding of different opinions as well.
Most excited to share. Favorite, not necessarily best.
Right, it's two very different descriptors. People like, I think, across any product, not just books, but people want to be reassured that what they're choosing is good, that they have a choice, that they have picked something that other people related to as well. How many people come in and they really do want to just look at the New York Times bestsellers because they feel a reassurance that, oh, if so many people are interested in that, it must be good. We get this little bonus of being, oh, well, it's the book experts in this world that are telling you that they liked this. So then it really must be.
Well, I feel like best is more intellectual and favorite is more emotional. Well, as we all know, the book challenge is happening all over the U.S. currently. Do you all have any advice as book people for librarians and library staff who are facing this kind of pressure to restrict access to certain materials in their libraries?
Way to follow a softball up with a hardball, Steve. So I think I would encourage library staff to remember that they are not alone in this. It's happening in communities of all kinds, all across the country, and that there are really strong resources there for support for you in general. So, you know, ALA and PEN America are both doing really important work in this area and offer a lot of resources and support. So I would really encourage people to take a step out of that immediate situation they're in and just broaden back out to the broader profession to find resources and support. I think that that could be helpful. And then I think some of the techniques, at least for me, that we have long used to promote our collections can still be really effective in this way. I think we've often talked about if you don't want diversifying your collection to be performative, then it has to be consistent and it has to be spread across your collection. So don't put up a Pride Month display, right? Don't do a display of LGBTQ plus authors once a year. Make sure that you have LGBTQ plus authors in all of your displays that you do all year, right? Make sure you're doing that with authors of color. Don't just put a display of Black authors up in February. You should be having books that represent the Black experience, highlighting and celebrating the Black voice all year round. And so you don't need to have a display that says like great mysteries by Black authors. Just have a great mysteries display. So I think that's work what we should be doing regardless. And in this time, finding ways to subtly raise those flags can be really important, right? A lot of what we talk about with library collections, with library displays, with programming is that we have the power to really help people feel seen in this world. We have the power to really expose people to stories and experiences that they might not otherwise do so. And readers who are looking for that kind of validation, we just need to make sure that they can find ways to see it, right? When I look at a display and I see it is mostly woman authors or authors in translation or any of these kinds of things, I can see that subtle signal that somebody's trying to send to me, that they are trying to cultivate and share parts of their collection that are not always so visible. So I think that kind of, I mean, I hate to say like underground work because it's not, it is just the work that we should be doing. I think that could be really effective, especially where we're seeing around these book bannings, people are really moving on to displays. So I think we have to be very, very thoughtful about displays. Most libraries do not have a policy. So this was a homework for public libraries listening. You really need to have a display policy that is as strong as your collection development policy. But if you're really doing that work and in a meaningful way, you're not creating a display that is easy for someone to come in and just say, that shouldn't be here. Because you are infusing your displays, you're infusing your staff picks, you're choosing what you put face out on your shelves. You're really doing that consistently in a way that is really hard for someone to pull the thread out on.
Yeah, if you can, the way you work, is there a way that you all can, as Library Reads, support diversity and inclusion in the books recommended on the list?
Absolutely. So this is something that we've had some criticism for in the past, and I feel like we do our best to address that. The ways that we do that are, first of all, people need to remember that the Library Reads organization and the board do not influence what's on the list. We all vote, but our votes count just as much as everybody else's. We don't tell them what to vote for, and we don't tip the scales one way or another. Where we do have the ability to tip the scales is in all of the author programming that we do. We are very clear about choosing a diverse group of authors for our author panels. And we always have been. From the start, before I came along, that was very clear that we wanted to have a wide range of authors appearing in our events. And we stick to that to this day. Other initiatives that we've done are, Stephanie, actually, I believe, is the person who started, that she came up with the idea for the Hall of Fame. Our Hall of Fame section of the website is authors who have hit the list 3 times. When that third book comes up, they are moved into our Hall of Fame, which means they still get the recognition for their book that month, but they are moved off of the main list, which creates more space on that main list, mostly for debut authors is what we're finding. We saw a really wonderful increase in debut authors appearing on the list. And we see a lot more diverse authors and different genres than we had been seeing previously come up on the list. The other thing that we've done in conjunction with that is this last year, we created a board bonus pick, which is a book that someone on the board read and has to at least have gotten some votes. We're not just going to pluck something out of thin air, but it didn't quite get enough to make it to that top 10. So a board member is saying, hey, I claim this book is something I want to make sure everybody sees. And when I was looking at it, because we're going to start putting them right now, it appears as bonus content on our social media. And then we're going to create printable lists to go along with it. And I was looking at it, and I think in the majority, non-white, non-pet authors. And then we didn't even do that on purpose. It just turned out that way. And then just this last month, we've included a notable nonfiction pick, which is also just, again, going to spread the wealth about who gets promoted here. So we do things like that. And we work with Nora Rawlinson, who has her wonderful early word trending list that she works on. She's got a whole spreadsheet of diverse galleys that are set to come out, and that gives people something to choose from. We're always encouraging people to read outside what you're usually reading. Make sure you're deliberately choosing non-white cishet authors, and that's a good resource to use to get those books. And so we have definitely seen the votes go up for that sort of thing.
I also think, especially under Rebecca's leadership, I'm not going to say Library Reads is the sole driver for this, because that is not the case. But I do think where Rebecca talked about Library Reads serving in that like clearinghouse, or that first stop, with publishers recognizing that, we were able as an organization to push the publishers and push the library marketing groups to talk about books in different ways and to talk about different books. So I do think Library Reads was very effective early on in saying, we don't want you to push what you've always been pushing on us. We want to know who is a debut author. We want to know your genre title. We want to know your authors of color. We need you to give us this information that you weren't giving before, pushing back on what they would offer up as authors for panels. So I do think that because we could speak in that clearinghouse single voice, we were able to really encourage publishers in the adult market because that was really absent. In the same way that the list focuses on adult titles, because there's such strong lists already in existence for youth titles, that movement, like the We Read Diverse Books movement, was really strong in youth titles and absent in titles geared for an adult audience. So I do think Library Reads was one part of things that were happening in connecting with publishers to highlight and push and market and share titles that really represented different experiences and breadth and diversity of experiences that was not the case before. Also, still a long way to go, but I do think that Library Reads is really important in that.
And for people who are not overly familiar with it, the Hall of Fame authors, that doesn't mean once you're in the Hall of Fame that you're just like shunted off and you're never spoken of again. You still mention when those authors have new books coming out and they still get noticed.
And we do still encourage people to vote for those books. It's not like once you make it into the Hall of Fame, we'll promote every single book you put out after that. Nope, people still have to read them. They still have to vote for them. But we do, on our social media, every book gets its own post so that the author gets tagged in it and they can share it easily. And every book gets on the printable flyer. We are really fortunate. Our friends at Booklist are putting our print list as the centerfold of their awesome new product, Booklist Reader. They do it as a two-pager. They do the regular list and the full Hall of Fame list, which is really great that we're still getting those books attention. And that was kind of our goal. We didn't want to stop paying attention to the bigger authors because, of course, their books are still wonderful and we still want to promote them. But we didn't want to have months where, you know, it's only we've gone back and forth about should we expand? Should we make it 12? Should we make it 20? And 10 just feels comfortable to us. We thought, how can we prevent having months where all 10 match the New York Times bestseller list? Because that's totally opposite of what our goal is. And doing a Hall of Fame was the perfect way to make that.
I think authors are really excited too. You know, a lot of the publishers have these kind of wonderful follow-ups that they do after the list comes out. And I think of HarperCollins in particular, which interviews the authors. And I feel like the authors are so excited to be able to say they're in the Hall of Fame. I really get the feeling it does not feel like a consolation prize. It feels like a leveling up.
Yes, I went to a bookstore event earlier in the month, which was Justin Cronin, author of The Passage and the Ferryman, being interviewed by Blake Crouch. Justin Cronin's book was our number one pick for May, and Blake is recently in the Hall of Fame. So I went up to the table after the interview was done and I went to go get my book signed and I gave them each a library pen. And I was like, you know, this is going to sound really weird, but I don't know if you realize this, but your book was the number one library reads pick. And Justin Cronin is just like, so excited. That was the best thing that happened this month. And I'm like, wait, really? And then I got to chat with Blake, who we actually have interviewed before. And now he's an Hall of Fame and he remembered all of this. So the authors absolutely are very excited to be recognized by library folks. I think it's that they understand that we are the people that know books the best, and it's exciting to them when we're embracing their books. So that was just kind of fun.
That's cool. So looking ahead, how do you envision Library Reads continuing to evolve in the future? Do you have any goals for the organization that you can share publicly? I'm sure you have secret goals.
Secret domination, world domination. Oh, that's a question because during the pandemic, the board was not able to meet for our usual annual retreats where we all get together and brainstorm over a weekend and figure things out. So I'm excited to bring folks together at ALA in Chicago this summer. I really want us to just sort of spend time talking about where we've been, where we are now, what we'd like to do, and then start working on a strategic plan. Our goal for the first 5 years has definitely been met by expanding our reach, expanding our user base. And now we're sort of entering into the last phase of everything that I had really wanted in these first 5 years, which is getting out to these smaller conferences and exhibits. And that is going to be our focus a little bit for the next year or so. But I don't really know where we're going to go in the future. It's up to the board and the fates to see what happens for us.
I think Library Reads has been really good at meeting the needs as they come out of the publishing world too, right? So I think things will continue to be happening with publishing consolidation, and Library Reads, I think, has been really effective in stepping into that space. Again, having Rebecca as the executive director is so great. And the steering committee and board members, the list is so incredible of who remains, who is and remains involved in this organization. So just really bringing together people who are thinking about these things. I think Library Reads has, for 10 years, been really effective at bringing those two pieces together. What's happening? What's our expertise? Or what do we see? So trends from the publishing and trends from the library side. I really imagine the organization is going to continue to be in that place where we're really effectively bringing those needs together in a way that really works for library staff. And so some of that is driven by the needs that library staff have.
And this might be a good opportunity for me to bring this up. We aren't just operating in a vacuum. Our current board is 10 people strong, and then we have a dozen plus of our prior board that are our advisory council, basically. And then we've also identified an additional 50 library staff folks that we were calling them our power users for a while. The people who vote every single month for multiple titles, and the people who show up again and again in those annotations, and the people who are really invested. They appear at all of the events that we have, all of our author panels. They come every month to the Twitter early word galley chat. All of those power users, we brought them together in an official capacity by calling them Library Reads ambassadors. And so we have this group people, and they are from all across the United States. There are all different types of libraries. We've got folks from big systems. We've got some from small standalones. All of these people who are invested in what Library Reads is doing. And so we poll them. We ask them, what do you need? What are the challenges you're facing right now? How is Library Reads able to help you when you're talking about books? What can we do for you? Are you looking for us? So we're definitely trying to make sure that we're meeting library staff with what they. So think of us as 10 additional books, well, really 12 now that we're doing our bonus pick and our nonfiction. So in minimum, as for example, the June list that just came out had 10 Hall of Famers on it. So think of it this way. This is 10 books minimum a month that you don't have to read in order to be able to promote. I say that every time we do a training and I'm introducing people to the list, I say, look at these annotations. We have carefully curated and edited down the annotations. So they are generally 3 lines long. It gives you just enough information about the plot of the book, just enough information about what the appeal factors are and who would want to read this, and just enough to compare it to other books so that someone can spend 35 seconds reading that annotation and have that book in their brain ready to suggest it to someone who comes into their book.
Rebecca and Stephanie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and congratulations again on 10 years of Library Reads.
Thanks, Sue.
Thanks for having us.
Circulating Ideas is produced in the suburbs of Atlanta. Views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of my place of work or the place of work of guests. For past interviews, visit circulatingideas.com and follow the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or a review. To learn more about this episode's guest, sign up for the Circulating Ideas newsletter. You can find the link in the show notes or on the site. Theme music is by Pamela Klicka, and the logo is by Shandy Fry. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating your ideas.